class is back in session. Summer vacation's ended. Welcome back. If you are a returning member of this community, welcome if you are a new member of this community. And the thing that I said a couple minutes ago, I'll repeat, which is meet the people here. These are remarkable people, and this is a remarkable group of people. It would be nice if people knew whom each other is.
There's four Barbara sitting together. What are the odds of that?
I don't know. You know how that probability thing is. If you get an open name, so you put them together. Maybe they just, there's some energy that, you know. Okay, so please sign in each week. I will read, because some of you registered after I printed that list last evening. Your name might not be on it. If that's the case, write your name on it, check that you're here, and then I will redo it for next week so the list includes everybody who's registered. If you aren't yet registered, please do that right after class. And each week, sign in so we know who's here. Announcements. I actually wrote a whole thing. You know, usually I don't do this, but there were so many things that I had to track on like that. Okay, so announcements. First, if you have, we can't, because of the way it works here, we can't have you make announcements of stuff you're doing in the community, wherever, in class. But you can bring flyers and put them on the table. So if you're doing a group or something, or you know something that you're doing that you'd like other people to know about, bring flyers and put them on the table. So when people sign in, they see these flyers. Couple of websites I'd like you to know about. First, mine, drspencersherman.com. I put up a few new things this summer that you might want to, especially things to read. But there are also audio materials that guide you through mindfulness meditation if you like being guided by audio materials. Also, swt.org/Spencer, that's a cooperative effort of Robert Bernstein and Michael Hedelwald. Michael records each class, and then the classes get put on swt.org/Spencer. So if you want to hear them again, or if you miss a class, you go there and you find the class. Also, there's selected other materials on there, which leads me to life stories. Where's Donna? Is she here today? Okay, so when she comes next week, we're going to continue the life stories, and they will also be put on swt.org/Spencer. Okay, a couple of announcements about classes. First, Joseph Bobro, who was here last spring, he's the retired psychoanalyst, very active Zen master, remarkable person, is going to give a class on September 17th from 9 to 12 in the auditorium. It's going to be a week from... 17th is like a...
Saturday,
right, it should be Saturday. So a week from tomorrow, in yeah, 10th, 17th, that works. A week from tomorrow, in the audience here, from 9 to 12, meditation and discussion, kissing the joy as it flies, Zen Buddhism and a life well lived.
When do you have to register by?
Say again?
When do you have to register by?
Before the class. I don't know what, you don't have to register at a particular time, you just have to register before that class. Okay. So that's a week from tomorrow here. I highly recommend, he's a remarkable person. Really a brilliant, heartful human being. And Carl Blasius, who is a member of our class, has a class coming up, so he's going to tell you a little bit about that.
We're going to talk about the simplified.
In a minute.
I'd like to talk to this class because my class was born in this class about 2 years ago. I gave some short presentations, and then I've been announcing it since then. If you're interested in your biological, physical self, as you are in your mental, spiritual aspect of your life, then you might be interested in the class I put together, Advances in Biology, Prospects for a Longer, Healthy Life. I've got this little flyer back there for you. We're meeting starting next month, five Tuesdays, October and then the 1st of November, to discuss the dramatic changes, understanding of the aging process that have come about through cell biology and molecular biology in the last few years. And I talked a little bit about a couple of the topics, including the aging hormones that have been discovered, aging and youth hormones that have been discovered by major university work in the last few years, and also the role of telomeres. So we'll be covering that and giving updates because there's been dramatic new developments within the last year in those fields. But other potential topics include epigenetics, nutrition, physical activity, hormesis, maybe that's a new term for you, the microbiome, and the common diseases of aging, like cardiovascular disease and cancer and other sarcopenia, things that plague the older population, like you and I. And I take a survey of the interests of the class each term to determine additional topics I want to cover. So we have like five sessions to hear from experts from all over the world and discuss what we hear. And it's pretty dramatic new developments every term. So I invite you to come and join us. And it's exciting. It's like Spencer's class, but focusing on some of the biology, the physical vehicle. Thank you.
Thank you, Carl.
It's remarkable what's going on right now in biology. And if you want a concise and authoritative look at that, that's where you go, because otherwise it's scattered all over the place and there's a lot of misinformation about it. So Carl's class is highly recommended.
Okay, so, very long. Okay, so what we're going to do now is mindfulness because, turn off your cell phone. All right on cue. Turn off your cell phones, please. We'll wait till everybody comes and sits. Class does start right at 10:15, really at 10:15. Wait till everybody sits down because mindfulness is, we don't want to be interrupted.
We can talk about the superlime
I'm not going to talk about that tonight, today, this morning. I'm going to talk about that when I know more about it. I don't know enough about it to tell you anything. I don't know. We begin each class session with mindfulness. And for this first session, I will lead you. As time goes on, I lead you less and less, so you can do what you're practiced at doing more and more. But because some people haven't done mindfulness, and also because it's good to get a tune-up, I'm going to lead you this morning. Each of these seven sessions that begin each of our seven classes is going to have a different emphasis that is going to tie in with the lesson for the day. Because mindfulness can be looked at in a lot of different ways, so each time I'm going to emphasize something different. And what that will add up to is it will enrich your meditation possibilities because you'll have looked at it from different perspectives. So, what I'm going to do with you right now, it's not going to be a long meditation session, but it will have three components. First component is I'm going to ask you to pay attention to your breathing. And my voice will tell you what to do. Second component is we'll go through the body and we'll relax each area of the body. We'll soften and open each area. And then the third component is we'll be present, so that the perspective we're emphasizing today is being present. What does being present mean? It means, first of all, being here, a feeling of being right here, of one's experience arranged around a place that we are. Not that we label that place, but that we feel here.
Now, you know about the power of now. There's been a lot of emphasis on being at this moment. But that's a cognitive kind of thing. That involves some thinking about past and future present. Whereas being here just is a feeling of presence. So I think here is even more powerful than now in terms of helping one be mindful. So being present, first of all, means being here. Second of all, it means being aware of what's happening, being present with what's happening around you and inside you. So you just notice that. You notice sensations coming in through your sense organs. You notice feelings that you're having. You notice thoughts that you're having. You don't try to do anything about any of those things. You just are present with them. And if you get lost in one, if you get sucked into one of these things, you come back out to your breathing, to your open awareness, and you just watch. So you know this, almost all of you know this ad nauseum, so I'm not going to go further. Why don't we sit, yeah? So maybe we should have the doors closed now, and I'll do that.
This work, can you hear me? I think probably for the mindfulness, I'll use this.
Because I'm not sure I can be mindful and go like this. But let me, if you can't hear somebody yell louder.
So again, is this a reasonable volume for you?
Yeah?
Yes. Betsy, can you hear me?
Yes.
Very good. Okay. So, sit upright, but not rigid. So you're sitting up in your chair, you're not slumping. Put both feet on the floor rather than having one leg crossed over the other. Thich Nhat Hanh says, sit like a mountain. Sit John Kabat-Zinn says, sit with dignity. So you sit upright with dignity, like a man. Notice if any article of your clothing is constricting you, is hurting you. If you need to, take off your shoes or loosen them so they're not pinching your feet. I think I'm going to do that. Just because if you're an experienced meditator, you don't meditate with your shoes on. If you can't breathe, loosen your belt or whatever is restricting your breathing, because breathing is going to be important. Is it important? And just notice that you're breathing. Don't do anything about your breathing. It will adjust itself. Just notice how it feels. What in your body moves when you breathe? What are the actual feelings in your body? Whatever you notice is perfectly okay. You're just allowing things to be as they are. You will probably notice that your body, especially the front of your body, rises and falls gently with your breathing. You may notice that especially your lower abdomen, your belly, moves in and out as you breathe. But really, if you're very sensitive, you will notice that your whole body participates in your breathing. With the in-breath, the body opens slightly and rises slightly. And with the out-breath, the body closes and falls slightly. And it's regular and rhythmic and soothing. If your mind wanders, just gently bring it back to being aware of the breathing. Just rest your attention on your breathing. You don't need to fix your attention on your breathing. Just let your attention gently rest on your breathing. Now, bring your attention to your face. Let your face soften. Generally, we wear an expression on our face, and there's some muscular tension involved in wearing that expression. If you let your face soften, that expression dissolves away. So the lines in your face smooth out as the muscles relax. And it feels like your face is softening, like you're opening in some way, like the tension is dissolving away. And it's leaving just a soft, open feeling. It's almost like your face is disappearing. It's becoming so soft and open. Your eyes are not held closed. They're just gently, softly closed. If there's tension in your jaw or mouth area, let it release itself. So you're just breathing. If your attention left your breathing to go to your face, then you can bring it back to your breathing. Notice that the breathing is happening, and that your face continues to become more soft and open, more relaxed, almost more not even there. And this softening and opening, this relaxation, this release of tension, now extends to the top of your head, sides of your head, and your neck, and the back of your head. So the top of your head, sides of your head, back of your head and neck, soften and open. You can feel your breathing because it's happening gently. Just notice it. You feel the softening and opening happen ever more exquisitely. in your face and head and neck. And now your shoulders and your arms and hands soften and open. If there's any tension held in the shoulders, arms, and hands, let that tension release itself. It's almost as though your shoulders, arms, and hands are disappearing. They're becoming so relaxed, so soft and open. Now bring your attention to your torso. And of course, you'll notice your breathing just happening gently. But also notice how your torso feels. If there's any tension in your upper back, mid-back, or lower back, let that tension release itself. So your back softens and opens. And the sides of your body and the front of your torso, your chest, area mid-torso, lower abdomen, softening and opening. Sides of your body, softening and opening. Even your internal organs soften and open. It's almost as though your torso is disappearing. It's becoming so relaxed. It's almost like it isn't even there. If your mind wanders, you just gently bring it back to your breathing and the softening and opening process happening in your torso. Now pay attention to your lower back, pelvis, legs, and feet. If there's any tension in your lower back, pelvis, legs, and feet, let it release itself. So you're softening and opening those areas. It's almost as though your lower body begins to disappear. It becomes so relaxed, so soft and open. And you can feel your breathing just happening easily, naturally, gently. It's as though your body almost isn't even there. And what is here instead is your breathing and your open awareness. It's as though there's a great spacious awareness in which your breathing happens and in which anything else that occurs is noticed. So at this point, you're simply open awareness without border, without boundary. Just a huge spaciousness. An openness, and the ability to notice whatever occurs. And what is occurring is your breathing. So you notice that, and you open your awareness ever further to notice whatever thoughts happen, feelings happen, or sensations happen. when there is nothing happening, simply notice your breathing and the feeling of being present and open to experience. You'll hear my voice in about 3 minutes. In that time, notice your breathing, soften and open, and notice whatever else occurs without becoming absorbed by it. If you do get lost in thought, when you remember, come back to your breathing and soften and open your awareness. If you're lost in thought, come back to your breathing, soften and open, and just breathe and notice whatever is happening. Of things about the mindfulness. First, you heard how silent it was in here. This is a lot of people. These are remarkable people to be able to sit this in this way. It's not the usual group of people. Second, depending on how much you practice mindfulness, one of two things happened when I stopped guiding you so closely. It was very easy when my voice was telling you what to do, right? I mean, that was a cinch, just paid attention to whatever.
But when I said, okay, now just notice what happened. If you have considerable experience in mindfulness, you just sat there and occasionally there was something to pay attention to, but mostly you were just kind of open. But if you didn't have a lot of experience in mindfulness, or if there's a lot going on in your life, then what happened was off to the races. And immediately, oh my God, you know, back into the usual way that we, our consciousness works, which is a lot of thought and a lot of agitation. So what we just did is we practiced a new skill. We're wiring into the brain something that is not wired into the brain unless you learn how to do it. It's called metta, M-E-T-A, awareness. It's awareness of awareness. So typically, this is you, a thought, a feeling, a sensation, and you just go from one to the other. What we're practicing week after week here, and what you may be practicing yourself, is the ability to take one step back and from an absolutely peaceful, open place, observe whatever the personality and body and world are doing. And that's something that has to be wired in. It's a new ability. It has to be learned. And that's why what we do at the beginning of these sessions is important. Because otherwise, it'll just be another, mindfulness will just be another bunch of thoughts. It'll just be a different color cloud or different shaped cloud. But we're going to talk about mindfulness week by week because it is a necessary but not, it is a necessary but not sufficient condition for well-being. Which leads me to why I called this course Beyond Mindfulness, okay? Necessary because I don't think you can be really psychologically well unless you learn to be mindful. I think it's a step that has to be taken, but I used to think it was the only step necessary. When I first learned mindfulness, I thought, okay, I get it. You just come out of all your crazy conditioning and you come to be this pure essence and you live out of pure essence, right? You don't have any of these stupid things that your personality has. You just live out of this stuff. And theoretically, that's still true. And I guess for some people, they have completely extricated themselves from these patterns. And they live entirely from this deeper, more universal part of themselves. And they always know what to do. And they always act from this kind of motivation. But I haven't gotten there yet. And I know it's gotten there yet. What we have learned to do is be less caught up in our stuff. Sometimes we don't get caught up in our patterns when they're not healthy. Sometimes when we do, we know we're getting caught up and we don't get as caught up and we come out more easily. So we now have two options. We are this most of the time, but we have the ability to come to this and to come out of this when it's not very functional. And that's necessary. But the question, so mindfulness is learning to take one step back from the usual way that we function. So we're more aware of it and less governed by it. But that's half the problem. But then the question is, how do you take a step forward into life in a more, a healthier way, a more effective way? And that's the beyond mindfulness part. Step two is, given that from here you're still going to have to make decisions about what to do and how to be, it's not a, you're not so purely here that those decisions don't occur. You're going to have to decide, what am I going to do? How am I going to react? What am I going to do next? You know. So the question is, how do you make better choices? And that's what we're going to look at. It's called well-being. We're going to look at that week by week. And that's where psychology comes in. Because psychology has, one of its charges is to examine that which makes us function better and teach us to be able to do that. So week after week, we're going to look at the strongest findings about how to make better choices in life and be and function at a better level, a higher level. That's why the class is called Beyond Mindfulness. Now, there is no way that in 7 weeks I'm going to be able to cover this ground, okay? So there's two things about that. First of all, of my voluminous notes for week after week, I'll get to some of it, but not all of it. And so the stuff I don't get to will get put into the bid for this winter, because I've already proposed an extension of this course for 8 weeks called Adventures in Aliveness. Okay. And by the end of this winter, they will know everything, right? But it won't happen.
Okay. For the winter, the course starting in January.
In January, right? Yeah. Don't go 8 weeks in January also. Okay. Try to do this in a formal way. Those of you who know me know this is uncharacteristic. This is too big of a topic to screw up. Okay. So, central questions that this course will address. First, what are the basic aspects of living? Because for each aspect, we want it to function as well as possible. First question is, what are the basic things that we should be focusing on? I have an answer to that, by the way. Second thing, for each of these aspects, what would a fully functional life be like? What would it be like if we could function entirely well in each of these basic aspects of living? Third, are there paradigms of wellness in these aspects that we can learn from, okay, using the internet and maybe some people in person, but can we get a feel for what it would be like to be fully healthy in this way by looking at people that are? And fourth, each week, could we do some homework that we individually chose to make us more healthy in this way? So if we contemplate something this week, we'll do some homework about being better at what we contemplated this week as homework, which you can do, you know, you'll choose what homework you do and how much you do it, but the opportunity will, the suggestion will be there to do the homework, and there'll be some suggestions about what sort of homework you might want to do. So this isn't just an academic exercise, it's an actual exercise of enhancement. So, format for each class. First, mindfulness, sometimes not as guided as this, but a different aspect each time, matching the focus for the week, then looking at a paragon, and then a homework. Okay. So, what are the basic aspects of life that we should be focusing on? What are the important things that define well-being? There are many different ways to answer that question, but because we have 7 weeks, and because the world's oldest positive psychology system has answered that better than anybody else, because they've had 5,500 years or something like that to work on it, I thought we'd use the chakra system that many of us are familiar with to define these 7 areas. And then each week, focus on one chakra, because that's one of these 7 areas, and build a progressive structure, so that we, at the end of 7 weeks, we're completely open in all areas of our life energy. I think there's probably a name for what I'm trying to do now, and it's probably not a complimentary one, but what the heck. Now, I have gone over with most of you the chakra system, so I'm going to hand out the handout I handed out last year, slightly edited, and I'm going to go over it, but briefly. Because, again, most of you are familiar with this, and we're going to week by week look in more detail. But I did want to, this is kind of a template. So, thank you, Chris. Everybody gets one of these, and we will refer to them immediately. So, Chris, there you go. And that's way more than enough. So, thank you both. They'll come back. I'm going to leave the lights off. So, okay, do you need that? If, who needs, who still needs? Raise hands if you need. Paul, you need it?
Yes, please.
Who else? So, if you can. Raise your hand. Okay. All right, so let's go over this briefly. We'll be returning to each of these areas, so I'm just going to make very introductory comments at this point. So the chakra system, this is about now. Oh, this is not, I don't claim to be an expert on the chakra system. This is my take on the chakra system adapted to the psychology. Okay. So I'm not claiming that this is exactly what different chakra teachers teach, especially since different chakra teachers sometimes teach different things. This is my extrication from the chakra system of what I consider to be the basic aspects of a functional life, or the basic aspects of life. We can use a metaphor here. Let's use the metaphor of a fruit tree. And we'll take that metaphor through these seven stages. So what does a fruit, when the seed of a tree, the seed of any plant, first hits the ground, what's the first thing the seed has to do? Put down a root, yeah, otherwise seed dies. Okay. So the base of, these in the chakra system, these centers are non-physical patterning energies, which correspond to physical locations in our body. So it's not that the chakras are in your spine, it's that they're in the basic energy of life, which on the physical level corresponds to the location. Okay. So the lowest chakra, the first chakra, or the first center of aliveness, I should more accurately call it, because that's what I call it, is located physically at the area of the base of the spine and lower legs. So it's how you stand in life. It's your rootedness in life. And how secure you feel on a basic level in being alive. I put a couple of questions that you could ask yourself to determine how open you are in this way. Oh, that's something else I got to tell you. Which is, in the chakra system, the idea is life energy is all around. It comes into you primarily from the earth, but it comes in from everywhere, and it's supposed to go up the spine and out the top of the head, so you're like a fountain of energy. Comes in without blockage, comes up and comes out, and also comes out this way into life for each chakra. So that the goal is to be entirely open, so the energy comes in without blockage, moves up and out without blockage, and moves out into life without blockage. But we have various life experiences that cause us to shut down in various ways, or to close, prevent the energy from being fully expressed. And being healthy involves opening those blockages. So, what we're going to focus on today is we're going to focus on this first area and how it would be were it to be fully open. What would it feel like? After the seed puts down a root and starts to gain nourishment, what's the next thing that the seed has to do?
Sprout.
It has to put out a sprout, right? And it has to put out a sprout toward that which nourishes its life. So it doesn't put out a sprout back down in the ground. It puts out a sprout toward the sun. So the second chakra at the level of the genitals is misunderstood to be sexuality. More generally, it's about pleasure. Because
pleasure in nature indicates that if that which is pleasurable is that which is life-giving. That's why you have pleasure wired into your nervous system, because the things that are pleasurable to you support your life in nature. Human beings have made pleasures that aren't life-giving, unfortunately. It fools our brain. But in nature, you want to go toward that which gives you life, you want to approach that which gives you life, and you want to avoid that which would hurt your life. So pleasure is essential in our life experience because it shows us where we want to grow. So that's the second area. Third area, after the shoot comes up out of the ground, then it has to become a stem, right? It has to become stronger so it can support the later structures. So the third area is about self. It's about having enough sense of self so you can get what you need to grow. It's about will. Okay. I call them the self factors. The factors that promote the development of a healthy sense of who you are, a capable sense of who you are. And again, there are questions that you can look at that will help you understand to what extent you are open or closed in this way. And we're going to, week by week, we're going to look at these things.
Okay. And you talk about the belly and the solar plexus now?
Yeah, that's the third one. It's the belly and solar plexus area. It's this area. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's the stem. So far, we're pretty much in ourselves. The fourth area is when the stem becomes a trunk and starts to put out the boughs. So you start to move out from yourself in this area. This area has to do with emotion and also with touch. Touching other people emotionally, being touched by other people emotionally, also being touched by other people physically and touching other people physically, embracing life. That's this area. And that in a tree is now you've got your bowels out. Then the fifth area, the area of the mouth, the throat, the lungs, has to do with expression, with creativity, with interchange with the world. The world comes in and out through your mouth, right? Food, air, in and out like this. So the fifth area has to do with the freedom to be who you are, express who you are, and take in what the world offers you. Communication is one aspect of this. So in terms of the tree, this is now the flowering. If you don't tell the world who you are, if you don't make your noise, if you don't play your note, if you don't make your noise, the world will not come and pollinate you because you have not shown the world your beauty, right? So when you flower, it's a signal to the world to pay attention to you and to interact with you in a healthy way. That's the fifth area. So after the flower is pollinated, then fruit happens, right? And that's the sixth area. The sixth area is the forehead and solar and third eye, the brain, basically. And it has two levels to it. One level is having an open mind and being eager to learn, curious, open to life experience and to other people's points of view. That's the more superficial level, and the deeper level is opening of the third eye, a whole different kind of knowing. And we're going to talk about that in detail. Okay? So that's the sixth area, and now you've got the fruit, and then the fruit comes off the tree and goes beyond the self. So the seed goes out into the world. And that's the seventh area, which I put in two places, both above, just at the crown and above the crown of the head, because many people feel the spiritual opening, the oneness feeling, the divine feeling, as something above, from above, but many people also feel it from deep inside. So I didn't know what to call it. I should have probably called it deep inside, but I called it essence. So
It's in two levels. It's in two areas, above and within. And in either or both of those ways, one goes beyond oneself. One joins to a larger unity. And that's the tree then making more trees. So that's, in a nutshell, a way to look at the various aspects of our functioning and how they progress from one to another. And so today we'll look, at least to some extent, at that very first aspect, the root aspect. Okay? All right, so I have a lot to tell you here. What I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you a little bit of it now, because I want to show you a paragon of basic trust, and that's going to take you about 20 minutes. Okay. So for 10 minutes or so, I'm going to tell you some stuff, and then next week, I'm going to tell you the rest of this stuff having to do with the first area, because the second area, I don't need to say so much about. I do have a paragon or two to show you of what it would be like to take full pleasure in life. So we're certainly going to treat that, but I'm going to divide next week's class into finishing first and going to second. Okay, so first, look, from the chakra system's point of view, if you're not open in your first chakra, then it means that there's not a lot of energy that can move up into the other chakras. So a person that's got a closure in terms of their feeling of security in life is not going to have a lot of energy to do anything else. So it's a really fundamental area that needs to be open. So where does this feeling... So this area in psychology is called basic trust. Basic trust. And many people have written about basic trust. I'm just going to tell you about about five of them, okay? First one is Erik Erikson. And we're going to look next week, I think, if we have time, which we probably will, we're going to look at Erikson's eight stages of development, because that's a whole other way to look at being a fully functional person. But Erikson's first stage of development has to do with the newborn. And the question is, when the newborn expresses her or his needs by crying, does the world meet those needs? Do people come and comfort and feed the newborn? Or does the newborn cry and nobody comes? At a very, extremely early age, the child learns either that the world is a safe place and listens to what I need and provides what I need, or the world is an unsafe place that doesn't care, that doesn't listen, that doesn't provide. And this is very pre-verbal and extremely powerful and shaping of the future life. I know the question comes up, what happens, you know, if you're... Now, none of us are completely open or completely closed in these ways. So the question is, how do we open further given where we are? Okay, Bruce Lipton told us maybe 10 years ago about the fact that if you stress rat mothers while they're carrying their pups, the pups, when they're born, already come out prepared for fight or flight. Their brains are actually configured differently. So this goes earlier than just your very early childhood experience. It goes to how your mama felt when she was carrying you. Was she anxious and stressed, or was she secure? That's already going to have consequences for how open, how much you trust life. Jerome Kagan at Harvard has for 50 years or so studied newborns, and he says newborns fall into three categories. About 10 to 15% of newborns are born timid from the day they're born. About 10 to 15% of newborns are born temperamentally bold. This is called temperament. And the rest of us are in the middle. So already at infancy, you see a difference in the pattern of how kids approach life. Some kids hang back. They don't trust what life has to offer. Some people are in the middle, and some people just charge into it.
again. When we talk about the fourth chakra, we're going to talk in more detail about attachment theory, which many of you know and which I've talked in this class about before. But attachment theory extends what Erickson said. It says, depending on what your history has been with significant intimate figures in your life, you either trust other people and the world, or you don't. And fifth, I got to just say a word about Stan Grof's work. I've talked in this class at some time in the past about Stan Grof's work. Stan Grof is the guy that has done the most to talk about pre, and especially perinatal psychology, P-E-R-I psychology. That means psychology around the birth process. What Stan says is, unfortunately, the roots of anxiety and depression are in every personality because of the birth process. But if you had a successful childhood, you never have to go to those levels and discover those roots. They don't become operative in your life. But if you have had a less than successful childhood, those problems are going to come out, and the roots of those anxiety and depression problems is going to go deeper than your childhood. It's going to go to the circumstances of your birth, and if you believe some folks, to the karma, which then gets imprinted into you by the circumstances of your gestation and birth. But I'm not going to go there. I'm just going to go to what Grof said. What Grof said is the root of anxiety, the deepest root of not safeness, is there's two possibilities for the womb environment. A bad womb, in which case the mother is smoking, drinking, very anxious, and the child from day zero, from conception, is gestating in an environment that is noxious. So that child is going to have a basic objection to life from day zero. But even in a good womb, when the child's needs are well satisfied, when the birth starts to happen, the womb closes down. So suddenly, paradise is lost. And that's the basis of anxiety. Okay. The basis of depression, according to Grof, is in the birth process, when the womb starts to contract, the cervix isn't yet open. So there's a period of time when you're trapped in a world, a universe that is closing in on you. That's called hell. It's a no-exit situation. Depending on how long you're in that situation, you have greater or lesser tendency later to have depression, because if you're in that situation for a long time, it kind of imprints more deeply than if you're there for a little bit and then the cervix opens, then you start to move out into the birth canal. So from Grof's point of view, anxiety and depression are deep in every psyche. But again, if you've had good life experience thereafter, you don't go to those levels. Those things don't become operative in your personality. Okay, so those are, in a lightning nutshell, those are a few of the points of view about why we have an issue about basic trust versus mistrust. Indicator of...
Spencer.
Robert.
True, though, that some societies have more trust and less trust? How does that fit into this?
How do they raise their kids? the societies that raise their kids communally, when one parent is gone, there's another parent there. So there's a more constant feeling of embrace, and there's a more secure, larger feeling of embrace. There's a lot of argument that we should be raising our kids more in that way because it makes more secure kids. That's one answer to that question. Okay. Sharon?
Yes. How do you spell it?
Grof? Stan Grof. Stanislav Grof. Grof. I'll probably talk more about him again at various points because he's utterly profound and startling. Michael?
My mother was in labor with me for 48 hours.
Yeah,
I have a memory. I swear it's true. I don't know if I'm in denial or what, but I have a memory that I liked it so much in there that I didn't want to come out. I don't
mean. Oh, now people have these intuitive hits that that I
that's, you know, I didn't want to come out. That was better than, you know. So that has something to do with basic trust of the world you're going into versus preference for, yeah. There's, Groff has all kinds of stories about, depending on the kind of labor you had and the kind of delivery you had, it has all these kinds of stories. But anyway, okay, so I got to go a little further, okay?
Is he also the one who talks about C-sections?
Yes.
Or twins, et cetera, and other shit?
Yeah, well, see, he talks about, I don't know if he says anything about twins, but C-sections, he says, a frequent complaint of C-sections is they don't have enough oomph. It's too easy, because they didn't have to struggle through the birth canal. And I don't know the data for that, but I know that I roomed with a guy at Esalen who was a C-section guy, and they ton of money really early, and he said, yeah, it's all so easy. He was so mellow, I'm like, struggle. Okay, anyway. Okay, so indicator of lack of basic trust is basic anxiety. The feeling of not being safe, and consequently being hyper-vigilant at some level for threat. So, okay, so next week, if I don't get to it, I'm going to show you the video now, because I want to show you this guy who's got basic trust, because I want to imprint it in you. But if we get to it after that, I'll do this. If not, next week, what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you some indicators of the presence of basic trust. How do you know if you have basic trust or other people have basic trust? What research has been done about that? And how to develop it if you don't have it enough. Okay, so that's going to be next week's topics. Now I think what I want to do is show you a paragon of basic trust so you can just get the feeling of what it would be like to be fully trusting of the world to provide that which is needed for life to thrive.
Can you say a little something about a paragon?
Oh, yes, I will, in a minute. A paragon is, paragon means an exemplar. Somebody who is a great example of. I gotta put the lights on so I can. All right, so I need to tell you a quick story about this guy. So here's a quick story. About 10 years, and we're going to eventually have this entirely closed because we want, unfortunately, the projector is not very bright. The good thing is it's not very bright outside. So we're fortunate in that regard. So, okay, about 10 years ago, this guy came to the Arlington Theater and gave a free talk. And the Arlington Theater filled up. I went to it, fortunately, and I was probably a couple rows from the back, so there was an ant on the stage way up there. But even so, I sat there and I listened to him, and I don't think I have ever in my life been in the presence of a person who had more personal power. There was more, in a good sense. He, just being in his presence was transformative. He just beamed this goodness out in a way that was, I've sat with a lot of gurus and stuff, but nobody ever did it for me like this guy did. Maybe it was just the mood I was in that day, I don't know. So who am I talking about? When you think of basic trust and you're an economist, you gotta think of one person. Muhammad Yunus. Muhammad Yunus, Y-U-N-U-S, is a Bangladeshi banker who founded the Grameen Bank, which pioneered microfinance, microloans. He gave to hundreds of thousands of incredibly poor people money. 20 or 30 or 40 bucks, so they could start a little business. And they had no collateral. You said, pay back so I can give it to other people. And people said, are you out of your mind? You're giving money to poor people who have no money. You're not going to get any of it back. Everybody pays back. Everybody pays back. Just started the whole microfinance craze. It's all over the place now. He won a Nobel Prize with the Grameen Bank in 2006, Nobel Peace Prize, for doing this, for transforming a significant proportion of the world in this way. Because when people get 20 or 30 or 40 bucks, they go out and buy some fabric, they make clothes, they sell the clothes, they get the money, they give back to him, they buy more, and they just needed the boost. So Muhammad Yunus had amazing trust in people to do this. But he's going to say more. Okay? So I just want you to be in his presence for a little bit. Get a feeling for it. No, this is not a TED talk. This is something I found on YouTube. Yes. Let me see if this is actually volume of video. This is quite a famous thing. What is this?
Email is the heart of your business, and a business email address is a great way to look professional to your customers.
Don't get caught up in your imagination to jump into it right away. Your first tiny step will make this all happen.
Don't feel that you have to be very smart to do something. Stupid people like us do things, it works out.
Because human beings are not always about money. Human beings are much bigger than just money-making machines.
All human beings in the world are entrepreneurs. That's in our DNA. That's in our blood.
She will give her life to make sure that trust is kept.
We think making money is the purpose of the life. Purpose of life is not making money.
When you imagine, don't put a limit. Be as wild as you can be.
Well, the thing that I see about the world, what it should be, it's all a question of imagination.
He's a Bangladeshi social entrepreneur, banker, and economist. He was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for pioneering the concept of microcredit and microfinance. He also serves on the board of directors of the United Nations Foundation. He's Muhammad Yunus, and here's my take on his top 10 rules for success.
Imagine big things, but always, this is my recommendation personally, always start very small, as small as you can get. Don't get caught up in your imagination to jump into it right away. Your first tiny step will make this all happen. So limit yourself into a tiny little thing of change and make that happen. It's easy. It's not difficult. If you make it very simple, make it easy.
Don't get scared if you don't know something. Don't feel that you have to be very smart to do something. Stupid people like us do things, it works out. So that's the fun part of it. Don't feel scared about challenging things. Conventional bankers are always telling me, we can't lend money to the poor people. You know why? Because they're not creditworthy. I heard it millions of times, telling me that they are not credit worthy. I wondered, should the banks tell people whether they are credit worthy or not? Or that people should be telling the banks whether they are people worthy or not? You reverse the whole question. Then you get it. So doing the opposite way, doing the stupid way, is not a bad thing.
Everything that we do in the business world is focused on making money. That's what indicator that you try to assess how successful we are. In the business world, there's nothing else. Mm. So that kind of squeezed out all kinds of social orientation of human life and human activity. And that's not a tenable situation. And that untenable situation is created by the structure that we have. I said business doesn't have to be always money-centered, always self-centered, always, or many times obsessed with money. Because human beings are not always about money. Human beings are much bigger than just money-making machine. We are not robots. We are human beings. Mm-hmm. We take care of ourselves individually. At the same time, we take care of everybody else. Mm-hmm. We take care of the planet itself. And business world doesn't have that orientation. So at the moment, we can do that. We can create a different kind of business, which is not money-centered.
The designing of education system is very important. It's not, I tell again, this is also relevant for education system, I tell that you don't have to wait to finally graduate, finally get your master's degree or whatever degree to get it, to become an entrepreneur. You can become an entrepreneur anytime you want. Any class you are in, whether it's junior high school or senior high school, doesn't matter. Because you're an entrepreneur. You don't wait for a certificate. You wait for a certificate when you will look for a job because you need this piece of paper to claim this is your entry document to get in. But entrepreneur doesn't need it. That doesn't mean that you don't need education. You need education to the extent that you are interested in, not because of a certificate. So certificate orientation can come if you're an entrepreneur. And make sure what are the things interest you and get through them, those kind of educations.
Who told you to have jobs? Did your teacher tell you to have jobs? Did you read it in your textbooks? Of course they cannot answer that question. I said, forget about jobs. Job is a very old-fashioned idea, obsolete idea. That should have ended in the last century. But somehow it sneaked in. Get rid of it. You keep telling yourself again and again, I'm not a job seeker, I'm a job creator. And behave like a job creator. Think like a job creator. Suddenly you see completely different thing emerging in front of you. It's in your head which causes a problem, not in your ability. You have the ability to become entrepreneur. And I tell them that all human beings in the world are entrepreneurs. That's in our DNA. That's in our blood. That's how millions of years we lived on this planet, by using that entrepreneurship. When we're in the caves, we're not sending job applications from cave number 5 to cave number 15, and you have a job for me. We carry the tradition of go-getters. We are go-getters. We are problem solvers. Some people mistaken it, converted into job seekers. I said, human beings are not born to work for somebody else. Human beings are much bigger than that. But the moment you accept a job, you limit yourself. Your life is made into a tiny little thing, which you yourself is a huge big thing. Your creative power can go any direction you want. That's what you should be.
Who have you seen an inspirational figure?
Well, I'm sure many people. Probably in an early stage when I was growing up, I would say my mother was my inspiration because she didn't go to school, study very much. She was just a fourth grade, fifth grade, probably. That's all about education she had. But a very unique character, very open, very helping person. So she always inspired me on that, whatever she did. The other one, inspiration I get from the people that I work with, all these women that work in the village, how hard their life is and how they work so hard to make a little difference in their life, to make sure
their children don't have to go through the misery that she has gone through. That's the only thing she does. And she's so committed, given this tiny money she gets in her hand, she tries to get the best mileage out of this money. When she received this first money, when we gave her loan from Grameen Bank, as I said, the initial loan would be about $30 or $35. When she holds this money, she literally shakes. She cannot stand still because she cannot believe anybody could trust her with such an enormous amount of money. She thinks, this is such a huge money, she doesn't know how to handle that money. So that's where the shaking part comes. And she, inside of her, she keeps promising, anybody who has trusted her all this money didn't ask for anything, just gave her the money on the basis of the trust. She will give her life to make sure that trust is kept. And her eyes will be, tears will be running down from her eyes, not believing that it's real. It's not a dream, it's a real thing. And the rest of her life, she struggles to make sure she makes that thing true, that yes, her trust will never be broken. And that's what keeps the whole Grameen Bank microcredit together, the relationship of trust between the two.
We think making money is the purpose of life. Purpose of life is not making money. Purpose of life is to make oneself happy and the rest of the world happy. But that purpose is forgotten. So we have to reinvent the purpose. What is the purpose of our life? That's what the young people are looking for. Mm-hmm. Human life is about creativity, about doing things so that it becomes a legacy. You build a legacy for yourself. That's not what we do in business. Mm-hmm. In business, we have a big stack of cash, and that's why we say goodbye. We have the capacity to change that thing. Nobody should be unemployed. Nobody should be poor. It's for the same reason. We are capable. Nobody should be welfare dependent.
Imagination is the real power. Imagine like I imagined about the app to transport me into your side. All the crazy things that you can think about. When you imagine, don't put a limit. Be as wild as you can be in creating the image of the world that you want to create. Without any hesitation, without any limitation. Be as wild as it can be in your imagination. As if you are writing social fiction. We write science fiction all the time. But unfortunately, we don't write social fictions. Fictions are the driving force. Like in science, in technology, science fiction becomes a driving force. It makes things happen. Similarly, if you have done the social fiction, it will make it happen.
Let's imagine that I was one of Grameen Bank's clients and I had a loan. But what mindset do I need for myself to succeed?
Well, succeed is that you take a loan to start a business. That's what you explain to the bank, that this is what I'll do. And you focus on that I have to be successful in this and make sure that I can pay back all the money out of the income that I made out of the investment that I did. And that, so the focus is very important, and self-confidence that mm-hmm. I can do it. Because many of borrowers, maybe like you, never had experience before, taking money from somebody else and doing things and paying back. They never handled money in many cases, because their husbands handled the money. But for the first time, they're handling money, so they're scared to death. So have confidence, make it happen, go step by step. And then once you have been successful in getting the money back, you become very confident you did it. Because you got through the whole process, came out successful. That builds up a tremendous amount of success. Well, the thing that I see about the world, what it should be, it's all a question of imagination. If we imagine today what kind of world we want, then that's the world we created. Everybody has the freedom to imagine in his or her way. My imagination is we want to create a world which will be absolutely free from poverty. Meaning that there will be no poor person on this planet anywhere in the world. And once we create that, we create poverty museums. So that people who would like to know what is it that used to be called poverty, how did it happen?
So they will go into poverty museum, they take their children to poverty museum. That's the kind of world I would like. And that would be the world where there will be no unemployment. And when you tell people, oh, they used to be unemployment, there's a big crisis, and there's a lot of unemployed people, the young unemployed, and people will be wondering, what is unemployment? Why should anybody be unemployed? They have capacity. Why? Well, a human being should be unemployed. What does it mean? They'll be writing thesis to understand what is unemployment. Why did it happen in those last days? And nobody should be on welfare. Why state has to take care of people, or any charity organization has to take care of people? Because human being has everything inside. How come we couldn't provide the facilities so that you can bring those capacities and contribute to the world? And we would want to create a world where there will be no unnecessary deaths. We pride about technology, we pride about knowledge. Simple thing. Why human beings die preventable diseases? Those diseases should be gone. So that's the kind of world, and a world where we will not make this planet more dangerous than it was before. We'll make it every day, we'll be more safe than it was yesterday. So we start thinking about it, and we start working towards it, and it will happen. When we create fictions, social fictions, it will happen like we do science fictions. We go to the moon, that was a science fiction. We go to the Mars, that was a science fiction. We go to another galaxy, that's a science fiction. Because we make those fictions, science follows them, make it happen. In the science fiction, there was something that we start talking to each other. If imagination can do it, reality should be able to do that too. And it's becoming more and more possible because all the science and technology is in the hands of us right now, much more than any time ever in history. Why can't we make things happen now? What is our excuse? Why should anybody be uneducated in this manner? Is it because of cost? Cost is gone. Science has made it possible, technology has made it possible. You don't have to just come to one classroom. The same class can be taught all over the world. And every single thing can be done. If we do not imagine, it will not be done. If we imagine, someday it will happen.
Thank you guys so much for watching. I made this video because Khalid Rahman asked me to. So if there's a famous entrepreneur that you want me to profile next, leave it in the comments below and I'll see what I can do. I'd also love to know who...
You bet. Okay. Let me...
So this guy, you know, he just epitomizes trust. He also epitomizes security. And he's, you know, this is going to happen. He asks, quite, you know, why can't this happen? Whereas anybody with a reasonable mind is going to think, oh, this can't happen. You know, there's too much of this and there's too much of that. Too much, you know, which I see as I'm not trusting that if you express your needs to the world, that the world will listen and meet those needs. That's what's learned at a very primitive level, is whether or not the world listens. So we got to talk about homework, right? First, you have to assess, to what extent do I have basic trust? To what extent do I feel secure? To what extent am I confident that I can create the effects in my life that I want to create? How much do I trust the world? How much do I trust other people? That's a good way to put it.
Trust other people.
Yeah. How much do I trust other people? Yeah. This is related to the question of how much I trust myself, but that's third chakra. So these things are tied together. Okay, so a couple of possible things for you to do this week to increase your sense of security in life. One is three good things that many of us have done before. Three good things, a very simple positive psychology exercise. You just, every night before you go to bed, you ask yourself, what are three good things that happened today, and why did they happen? And you either write it down in your diary, or you just ask yourself. I do it every night before I go to bed. What are three good things that happened today, and why I think they happened? You know, I learn a lot from the answer to the question, why do I think they happened? There are some interesting answers that come there that open your eyes a little bit. But the finding three good things, first of all, there are some days when it's hard. And what does that tell me about the way that I'm living? If you ask me, find three crappy things that happened today. Are you kidding? Already, my toilet overflowed. I overslept. But three good things and you can't find them? What does that tell you? You know? But the idea is when you do this, it begins to break the illusion, the semi-depressive illusion that many of us have, that things are not okay. Because you're focusing, you're making salient those things that are okay. And after a while, you start to walk around during the day, cruising for good things. And so you're focusing on the positive, and you put them, you know, oh yeah, that's one I'm going to say to myself tonight. You know, and you gather good things. And it changes the way that you feel about the world. Because you're perceiving the world not as inimical, you're perceiving the world as friendly, as providing these good things. So this exercise is super easy and real. It has a lot of empirical evidence to show that it works pretty much across the spectrum of mental health, at least to the level of moderate depression. Okay? Even moderately depressed people can get appreciable boost in their mood from this. If you, there's an allied exercise called gratefulness, thankfulness, which is, it's done different ways by different folks, but some people like that flavor better. What you do for that is you, at the end of the day, you ask yourself, what am I grateful for or thankful for? And you come up with, you know, some people do three, some people do 10 a day, some people don't have a number on it, but you try to come up with new things each day. Not just, I'm thankful for this, you know, I'm thankful for what's a new thing? And so you start looking more broadly at what's right in your life. I'm grateful for the fact that I have a toilet, even if it did overflow. You know? I'm grateful for the fact that I ate. I'm grateful for the fact that I can walk. You know, I'm grateful for the fact that I have eyes. You know, and it, so you do this, and after a while, it just changes the way you feel about the life in which you live. A third thing that I would suggest that you might want to think about is what are your main myths? This is a big question. What are your main myths? What stories, childhood stories, movies you've seen, heroes that you have, really resonate with you?
What does that mean?
Resonate means make you, they you think that's me. And so you identify your myths. One of my main myths always is the Emperor's New Clothes. You know? I thought, that's me, man. I see right through, you know, which is true. I mean, it's really true to who I am. I mean, you can't, I'm from New York. You don't bullshit me. I know who's profiting. And, you know, that. But having that myth is a depressive kind of thing to go through life with, because you're always seeing the nakedness. You're not seeing the show, you know. So you have to identify these are the main stories, the main narratives that I operate on. And then you have to rewrite some of those stories or choose different ones. So I have to rewrite the ending to The Emperor's New Clothes to have another chapter. So that once I see that the emperor is naked, then I, you know, say, you know, I see that really you're just fooling yourself and other people. How can we clothe you worthy of an emperor?
What would it take, Emperor, to clothe you? And so I'm rewriting a story. And so what I'm rewriting is my own story. So it's not just I see what's wrong, but I start to see how to fix it. And that's just one example. So the question is, what are your main myths? What are the stories that and the heroes that resonate most with you, and to what extent are they coloring your or determining your perception of life? So you have to identify those myths, and then you have to rewrite them or change or select different ones. Otherwise, your narrative is going to determine your reality, and that narrative is going to be a less than secure, happy narrative. So those are some suggestions for how you can work on basic trust. Next week, I'll give you more suggestions when I talk about how to build basic trust. I know I'm leaving you on the ice floe here. Do the best you can. Next week, we'll pick it up. Have a good week. I hope that this week supports your life and your view of life as being worthy of living. Okay. See you in a week.